Deutsche Welle, World in Progress.
With Rio Plus20 getting underway this week, we look at an indigenous community in Brazil being threatened with eviction so preparations can be made for the 2014 Soccer World Cup.
Of course I'm worried. We're all worried. The government has never respected the rights and wishes of indigenous people. They began construction in front of our main entrance, so we had to close it. Obviously, without any kind of explanation.
With World Refugee Day being held this week, the UNHCR has released a damning report about the dire needs of refugees around the world.
We have about 800,000 people who became refugees in 2011, which is actually the largest numbers of refugees, of new refugees, in more than a decade.
And more than a year after NATO forces attacked Libya, ousting dictator Muammar Gaddafi, there is one success story coming out of Libya: oil. But its trade is far from transparent.
The real price outside is $10, and we find inside the contract, for example, $4 or $3. There's a corruption inside this contract. This difference, they will get it by commission outside.
Hello and welcome to World in Progress. I'm Jessie Wingard in Bonn, Germany. While the Rio Plus20 Summit, the UN Conference on Sustainable Development, has kicked off in Rio de Janeiro this week, another major international event is set to get underway in Brazil in 2014. All eyes will be on the country when they host the Soccer World Cup. But what's going to happen to the many indigenous communities threatened by World Cup development? One group of Brazilian indigenous Indians in Rio de Janeiro are being threatened with eviction from a space next to the Maracanã soccer stadium where they have lived for the past 6 years. Just this week, it was announced the building they inhabit would be demolished. But the Indians are claiming the space is sacred and they will resist eviction at all cost. Sam Cowie has this report from Brazil.
In Rio de Janeiro, construction work continues on the world-famous Maracanã football stadium, preparing the venue in time for Brazil to host the 2014 World Cup. Next door to the stadium stands a dilapidated building decorated with tribal paintings, once Rio de Janeiro's Museum of Indigenous Culture. The building has stood since 1846, originally donated by Brazil's federal government as a centre for the studies of indigenous peoples. In 1978, during Brazil's military dictatorship, the museum moved to Rio's Botafogo district. The building has remained abandoned since then. In 2006, a group of Brazilian indigenous Indians moved in to preserve the space. Today, around 30 Indians of different tribes use the space as a showcase for their culture, holding weekly events and selling crafts. Indigenous peoples from across Brazil use the space if they need somewhere to stay while travelling. Now, with the World Cup in 2014, the entire Maracanã neighbourhood is undergoing intense development and the Indians are facing eviction. In the garden, members of the community cook river fish wrapped in leaves. Some tend to the plants while others paint themselves in traditional patterns, preparing for guests.
38-year-old Miquel Oliveira of the Arawak tribe lives in the village with his four children.
He came to Rio from Manaus in Amazonia to study. He's currently in his seventh semester at the State University of Rio de Janeiro, just a few hundred metres from the village and stadium, studying history, archaeology and indigenous studies. He explains the community's concerns.
Of course I'm worried. We're all worried. The government has never respected the rights and wishes of indigenous people. They began construction in front of our main entrance, so we had to close it. Obviously, without any kind of explanation. There's never been any kind of dialogue between us and the state, even before the works.
Rio de Janeiro State Governor Sergio Cabral announced this week that the building will be demolished to make way for a new entrance to the Maracanã Stadium. FIFA have stipulated that 10,000 car parking spaces must be made available around the stadium. When the demolition occurs is yet to be announced and the state has made no contact with the Indians. Although the Brazilian federal government owns the building, under Brazilian law, those who occupy a space for 5 years peacefully are entitled to ownership. For the indigenous people, the building and space has a special meaning. It was the first museum of indigenous culture in Latin America and was the original headquarters of the first indigenous movement, FUNAI. Given the building's historical and ancestral importance, the Indians are not interested in being relocated and will resist any attempts at eviction, they say. 43-year-old Kuati shares his time between the Maracanã space and his village in the Porto Seguro district in Bahia, in Brazil's northeastern region. He explains why the community are not willing to leave.
We haven't been offered anything else, but even if we were offered, we're not interested. We want this space. This is a space that has our story and our history. My people, the Pataxó, we never get into a struggle without expecting to win. In the same way we've struggled for other spaces, we'll struggle for this one. When I say we, I mean everyone, our people.
Under the UN Declaration of the Rights of Indigenous Peoples, of which Brazil voted in favour of, it states that the culture of indigenous peoples must be respected and maintained.
Last month, both the UN and Amnesty International criticised Brazil heavily for their treatment of indigenous peoples across the country. Just last week, the annual report of violence against indigenous peoples in Brazil, taken by CHIMI, the Indigenous Missionary Council, reported that physical violence, intimidation, and displacement of indigenous peoples has continued to rise across Brazil in recent years.
46-year-old Alfonso of the Alucera Camicua tribe explains that the village could provide a unique opportunity to showcase indigenous culture at the World Cup.
We want this space to be a centre to inform the public during the World Cup and Olympic Games. We would welcome tourists here and show them a different and important part of Brazilian culture. We have many different Indian groups passing through here, so this could be a tourist centre. We can coexist with car parks and shopping centres. As long as they leave our space tranquil, we don't mind.
Despite the demolition announcement, the mood in the village is optimistic. Alfonso explains that he is confident that they will be successful and that the community will be maintained.
I'm confident in the struggle. I'm confident that everyone will realize that this is a sensitive issue. It's a struggle that involves a whole culture and people. Also, for some, reparation for the injustices against indigenous peoples. I'm confident that the authorities will come round and understand the importance of the space.
This week, around 1,200 indigenous peoples will gather in Rio de Janeiro for the Summit on Sustainable Development to discuss common strategies for the indigenous movement. A number of Indians will also demonstrate outside Maracanã in a show of solidarity.
For Michael, Kuati, Alfonso and the other members of the Maracanã village, the future remains uncertain, but they will continue to fight for the space and for their culture. Sam Cowie, DW, Rio de Janeiro, Brazil.
For more news and information on Rio de Janeiro and the Rio Plus 20 Summit, be sure to head to DW's specially dedicated summit webpage at dw.de/Rio_20. World Refugee Day is being held this week, and the United Nations Refugee Agency, UNHCR, has issued its Global Trends Report, revealing that 2011 saw the highest number of newly created refugees in over a decade. Earlier, I spoke with Volker Türk, Director of Protection at the UNHCR, and began by asking him what the current situation was like globally for refugees.
We have seen quite interesting trends compared from 2010 to 2011. In fact, we have about 800,000 people who became refugees in 2011, which is actually the largest numbers of refugees, of new refugees, in more than a decade. And that's the result of a number of crises over the last year. As you know, in the context of the Arab Spring, we have seen quite a few number of new displacement situations and refugee situations as a result, but also the crisis in the Horn of Africa and earlier this year in the Sahel zone in Mali has produced quite a number of new refugees. And added them on to the already quite significant number of forcibly displaced people around the world, which stands at around 42.5 million.
How has the situation changed for refugees in the last 12 months?
Well, we have seen more emergencies that have arisen over the last year. We have seen the Libya conflict. You have seen a different situation in the Horn of Africa with Somalia, where you have an ongoing conflict plus drought, which produced refugees fleeing into Kenya and Ethiopia. In fact, at some stage during the summer last year, we had about 1,000 people coming daily into Kenya and Ethiopia. So you can imagine the numbers of people arriving. If you compare this with the industrialized world, we have seen some increases, but compared to what we have seen in the developing world, there's absolutely no comparison. I mean, if you look at statistics in the industrialized world, we have about 20,000 more asylum applications. That equates to what Niger and Burkina Faso faced within a couple of weeks in terms of new arrivals. So I think the comparisons are quite staggering in that sense. What we have also seen is that old conflicts do not get resolved and new conflicts erupt. So we have more and more a situation of increased people in protracted displacement.
You talk there about conflict, but what factor do things like drought and climate change play in people being displaced?
Well, the immediate triggering effect of displacement is usually violence and conflict. But we're just launching a report at Rio+20 at the summit that we did together with UN University, where we did some in-depth interviews with a couple of refugees in the Horn of Africa, where we asked them what their experience was and how have they experienced climate change, environmental degradation. And it is interesting that they have seen over the last 10 years significant changes in weather patterns, rainfall, increased drought, which made them move to more urban areas. So they actually moved into areas of conflict in some instances because they couldn't survive anymore in the areas where they previously lived. So if you like, it's not that climate change and environmental degradation are the immediate triggering effects, but they are compounding already existing vulnerabilities. People move into conflict areas as a result. And of course, it's then conflict that produces refugee movements. But climate change is certainly a very important factor behind some of the initial movement for people to move away from uninhabitable terrain or a terrain that is seriously affected by environmental factors.
Are refugees high enough on the international agenda?
We wish refugee protection would be much higher on the agenda. It means that refugees are at risk. They flee circumstances of violence, of conflict, of persecution. We wish that there would be more effort that goes into solutions. And quite frankly, if you look at the Sahel situation, our program there and the Mali situation and refugee movements around there is only funded for about 13%. So it is clear that we would hope that the whole refugee issue is put back on the agenda as an international issue that needs attention, that needs funding, that needs support from individuals around the world who show compassion and empathy towards refugees in their daily dealings with them.
So what needs to be done on a grassroots level?
I think it's important that there is more understanding about who refugees are and that we understand where refugees are coming from. Unfortunately, there is too much negativity around refugee issues and asylum issues. There's a lot of racism and xenophobia around it as well, especially in today's economic and financial crisis. But it is important that individuals understand where refugees are coming from, that they have absolutely no choice but to move, that they require our international solidarity, that they require our understanding and empathy. I think that's really what is important. And a lot is actually being done at the grassroots level in many countries around the world. We see that non-governmental actors, the They accommodate refugees, they help them integrate, they help them go into the asylum process through legal aid and other things. And that is very, very important and very much welcome by all of us who work for refugees.
Volker Türk, Director of Protection at the UNHCR, speaking about the worrying situation for refugees around the world. And now we'll take a quick look at some development news with Saroja Coelho.
Rio Plus 20 meeting kicks off. One of the most important summits on sustainable development is taking place in Rio de Janeiro this week. It's the 20-year follow-up to the United Nations Earth Summit. The goals have been outlined in a document called The Future We Want. World leaders, civil society groups, and experts from all over the world are discussing issues such as how to promote environmentally sustainable growth. Other topics are green employment, energy, better housing, and less pollution for cities. They'll also tackle feeding today's more than 925 million hungry, as well as the additional 2 billion mouths expected by 2050. Myanmar to boost economic development. Myanmar's leaders vowed Tuesday to put the economy at the center of the next wave of reforms. They are aiming to boost development in the impoverished country following a series of dramatic political changes. The government says it wants to bring in economic growth of 7.7% a year on average over the next 5 years by attracting overseas investment. Since taking power in March 2011, the government has made enormous changes. They have released hundreds of political prisoners and welcomed the opposition back into mainstream politics. Companies are eager to enter Myanmar as it has huge reserves of oil and gas. Ethiopia forcing pastoralists off land, Human Rights Watch. Ethiopia is forcing thousands of pastoralists off the land in southern Omo Valley to make way for sugar plantations. That's according to a report released by Human Rights Watch earlier this week. The Ethiopian government denied the charge, saying any relocation in the area is happening voluntarily. But Human Rights Watch estimates that between 5,000 and 10,000 people from indigenous pastoral communities have been displaced in Ethiopia's Omo Valley, and that without adequate consultation or compensation. About 100,000 hectares of land has been earmarked for commercial agriculture in the area, which according to the government will help modernize the region. However, the rights watchdog accused Ethiopian authorities of intimidation, arrest, and violence against those who opposed the plans. Korean Air apologizes to Kenya over primitive energy ad. Korean Air issued an apology on Monday after describing the primitive energy of the Kenyan people in an advert for the upcoming Seoul-Nairobi route. They have withdrawn the ad from their website. Fly Korean Air and enjoy the grand African savanna, the safari tours, and the indigenous people full of primitive energy, the airline said in their advert. The ad provoked a wave of reaction from Kenyans, most of them amused rather than angry. Thinking of lion hunting today and maybe some elephant baiting to deal with my primitive energy, tweeted one Kenyan. After hundreds of tweets were addressed to them, the airline said in a statement on their website, "We sincerely apologize for the situation." Saudi rights activist faces trial. Prominent Saudi rights activist Mohammed Al-Qahtani has appeared in court over charges that include setting up an unlicensed organization and rebelling against the authorities. Qahtani is the founder of the non-governmental Saudi Civil and Political Rights Association. Other charges include accusing the judiciary of permitting torture and questioning the beliefs of the members of the Supreme Council of Islamic Scholars. On Tuesday, he accused the authorities of cracking down on the kingdom's human rights defenders and silencing those who demand political reforms. Qahtani remains free pending his next hearing in September. Human rights groups say Saudi Arabia is currently holding some 30,000 political prisoners.
That was Saroja Coelho with the development news. There is a treasure deep in the waters of East Africa's Lake Kivu, methane. For a country like Rwanda, the gas has the potential to be as valuable as oil, but it could also be a terrible hazard. Antje Diekhans travelled to Rwanda to find out about a new project to extract methane for energy production. Her report is presented by Chiponda Chimbelu.
Hervé leaps into the air and splashes into Lake Kivu. It's a swimmer's paradise for the 14-year-old and his friends. They meet here at the shore every day. We come here to swim and collect water, says Hervé. He knows that this lake is somehow special. And that's not just because of its palm trees or scenic views. There are large reservoirs of methane and carbon dioxide lying deep beneath Lake Kivu's surface and along its shores. Methane is a combustible gas, ideal for use in electricity generation and heating, and it's the main component of natural gas used in cookers. Here, it's given off by rotting vegetation which has collected for millions of years at the bottom of the lake. If Rwanda can tap it, this energy reserve could be worth billions. An extraction project has already begun. In the Rwandan city of Kibuye, which lies next to Lake Kivu, workers are busy building a pilot station for the extraction of methane. Large pipes extend from the platform where the harvested methane will be processed. Roy Mortar is an American engineer who heads the team here. He has launched power plant projects around the world, but this is still a new experience for him.
I've never worked on anything quite like this. The power plant side, yes, that is a conventional standard power plant, but this is first of its kind.
The methane processing station will be assembled on land and then transported to the lake. It will be raised onto 30-meter-high support towers. The methane will be sucked out of the lake through pipes that act like giant straws, but the carbon dioxide will be pumped back into the water. Some experts say that could be dangerous. With little experience to guide them, no one here can be sure what will happen to the lake. While the gases can be tapped for energy, they can also kill. In the mid-1980s, in Cameroon, more than 1,500 people were killed by carbon dioxide erupting from Lake Neos. Mortar believes that's not a risk here. In fact, he says the explosions could help get methane to the surface.
A close analysis is to think of a champagne bottle, that when you release the pressure in a champagne bottle, the bubbles come to the surface. And that is effectively what we're doing by releasing the methane and the carbon dioxide from up to 400 meters deep in the lake. And then as they go through the separation process, the bubbles will be taken out.
But the lake's rare chemistry also presents Rwanda with a financial opportunity. It's estimated that it's possible to harvest years of energy for the countries of the African Great Lakes region from here.
Rwanda will not have to worry anymore about energy. That's correct. That's why this project is so important to Rwanda and why we work so closely with the various ministries within the Rwandan government.
Meanwhile, negotiations are continuing. Experts warn that if a methane explosion occurred, some 2 million people could be injured or killed. Chipona Chimbelu for DW.
15 months ago, NATO planes attacked the armed forces of Libyan dictator Muammar Gaddafi, toppling the regime he had on the country for so many years. Today, the country has a weak central government and is challenged by a chaotic assortment of armed militias. But oil production has almost returned to pre-war levels. Rhys Ehrlich travelled to Libya to look at the role of oil in the post-war era. He begins the story at a refinery 45 miles or just over 70 kilometres west of Tripoli.
Khalifa Saleh, operations manager here at the Zawiya oil refinery, shows me an enormous grid of pipes and tanks. He boasts that the facility has up-to-date equipment. The refinery even produces most of its own drinking water.
This is to produce water for drinking and for processing, and mainly for drinking.
Oh, I see. So it's a desalinization unit to turn seawater into drinking
water. That's right.
I asked Saleh if the refinery's production of gasoline and other fuels has reached pre-war levels.
The production today at 15 minutes after 11, the capacity is 102% capacities for both process units.
So it's over 100%.
Yes, please.
Oil is one of the few success stories in today's Libya. Shipments to Italy, France, Germany, and other countries are approaching pre-war levels. But the country's political system is far from successful. Armed militias vie for power with the central government. Some Libyans say the ongoing fighting could turn their country into another Afghanistan or Iraq. El Habib Alamin is a well-known poet and official with the Ministry of Culture. He fears that Western powers will abandon Libya's struggle for democracy.
Those wars in Afghanistan and Iraq didn't result in improvements for the people of those countries. I think some leaders here in Libya are trying to get Western backing to become the next Hamid Karzai. I don't want Libya to become an ATM for Western oil companies while they abandon the people of the country.
Foreign oil companies are a sore spot for Libyans because of the country's long history of corruption. Ibrahim Ali, chair of an NGO called the Libyan Transparency Association, says that the old regime were thieves. Oil would be sold at world market rates, but European companies actually bought the crude at much lower prices. He says the corporations and Gaddafi cronies pocketed the difference.
The real price outside is $10, and we find inside the contract, for example, $4 or $3. There's a corruption inside this contract. This difference, they will get it by commission outside, and you don't know. Till now, it's like that, you know, and nobody knows about these things, you know.
Ali and other NGO activists demand that the government publish the oil contracts, along with a detailed budget of how the Libyan government spends its current oil revenues. But the oil industry strongly objects. Ibrahim Lias, an official with Medco Energy Oil and Gas, says foreign oil companies don't want contract terms made public because one company may be getting a more advantageous deal.
The contracts between the oil companies and the NOC, that's very, very confidential. There is no third party can read it, you know. And it's confidential because each contract is unique by itself. You don't want even other companies to know about it. Some things, you don't want the public to see it.
Alamin says the oil companies will have to reveal their contracts sooner or later.
The Libyan people need transparency about the relationship between foreign countries and our government and about the economic contracts. Someday it will come out. If it's secret, the Libyan people will be very angry at the government.
Demonstrators here in the city of Benghazi are demanding an end to corruption and dissolving the militias. They look forward to elections for a National Assembly. The Assembly will choose a new government and be responsible for writing a new constitution. But protester Abdul Wahab says a new government will probably not resolve the issues of corruption and militias.
So this chaos and this disorganization will have to carry on for some years before we establish a firm nation with laws, a constitution that everybody adheres to.
Last year, NATO sent planes and ships to Libya with the stated goal of protecting civilians and promoting democracy. Libyans are now wondering if protecting oil resources, not building democracy, was its real goal. Wahab says Libyans worry that continued political chaos could produce a new dictator.
They're worried about a new strongman emerging.
A new strongman emerging using his own militia to impose his will upon the Libyan people.
I'm Reese Ehrlich, DW, Tripoli, Libya.
And that's all we have for you today. If you want to listen to this show again or check out past editions of World in Progress, go to dw.de/globalization. There you'll find more reports on globalization, education, economic development, human rights and more. You can also check out our special on the Rio Plus 20 Summit at dw.de/Rio_20. On behalf of today's studio team, I'm Jesse Wingard in Bonn, Germany, saying thanks for listening and goodbye.
Você viu só que amor, nunca vi coisa assim. E passou nem parou, mas olhou só pra mim. Se voltar, vou atrás, vou pedir, vou falar. Vou dizer que o amor foi feitinho pra dar. Olha, é como o verão. Quente o coração e o coração salta de repente pra ver a menina que vem. E ela vem, sempre tem em cima no olhar. E vai, tem dizer, nunca tem quem amar. Hoje sim, diz que sim, já cansei de esperar. Nem parei, nem dormi, só pensando em me dar. Peço, mas você não vem bem. Eu deixo então, falo só, digo ao céu, mas você vem.